Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mining disaster in West Virginia this week. A shift change, a huge explosion, and the biggest death toll in this state in mining in many years. How could this happen? Asked the Charleston Daily Mail in an editorial. This is 2010, not 1910. In this day and age, said the paper, just miles from the Upper Big Branch mine, this should not have happened. This hour, On Point, we'll talk with coal miners about the disaster at Upper Big Branch and what goes on down in the mine. Miners Jeffrey Harris and Adam Vance join us in a moment from West Virginia. But first today, from Charleston, we turn to Beth Voorhees, producer and host at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. She's been following the story and rescue efforts all week. Beth, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, Tom.
So tell us about what happened this morning when they finally cleared enough methane gas out of this mine. What time did who go in? How deep are they going? Where does it stand as we speak?
Crews entered the Upper Big Branch mine just before 5 o'clock. They got the clear that the air inside the mine was clear enough that they could go ahead. What they're doing is going in by the man trip, the actual tracks that take miners in and out of the mine, and they're making their way towards those sections of the mine that have not been checked yet. They're looking for the refuge chambers that they're hoping the four missing miners may be in. They're taking it very, very slowly. If they find that there are pockets of methane gas that are still in the mine, they will have to retreat and start again. They'll have to poke another hole at the top of the mountain in order to ventilate the mine some more. And then they will go back into the mine try again. And in the meantime, also, there is a recovery mission here. We know that there are 18 perished miners there. And so part of this operation is also retrieving their bodies.
So four men missing, and that the main target of this crew going in, as we speak anyway. Now, for some of our listeners, by the time they hear, we may know a lot more about what's been found down in the mine. But I wish you'd give us a sense just of the underground kind of layout or geography of this. But at the shift change, at the site where so many appear to have died at once, how far from the mouth of the mine is that? And the four missing, are they presumed to be in that area or somewhere else? Give us a sense of the topography down there.
They are very, very far away from the mine entrance. I don't know how many feet they are from the actual mine entrance, but they are deep, deep, deep inside the mine.
25 confirmed dead early on, but not all of those, as you say, 18 of those bodies not yet recovered.
Yes, that's right.
So are the four in that same area, or are they distant from them? Do you know?
They're in just about the same area, a little deeper back than where the men were who perished in the explosion. They're a little deeper far back. And they're hoping that these men are in one of these refuge chambers, that they are trained. Once these refuge chambers made it into the mines, and these are new. This is the first time they've really been tested. The refuge chambers came out of the Sago mine disaster. So they're hoping that these four men made it into one of those two refuge chambers, and they will find them there. These are airtight. They contain extra oxygen, food, water, everything that they need for at least 96 hours. And they're hoping that perhaps that's where the men went to. These men are trained to know that that's what they do. If they survive the explosion, then they are to go to a refuge chamber.
But with all the drilling that went down from the surface and the banging and knocking, hoping for a response, none was heard. Hopes, as from what we're reading here at least, not terribly high at this point for those four. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong at all. You're not wrong at all. If we find that they have taken shelter in one of these chambers and it worked, this is going to be a very, very big story. But if they did not make it to a refuge chamber, then, well, then, you know, hopes are very, very slim. But the governor of West Virginia is still hoping, and the families are still hoping that perhaps their loved ones are safe in a shelter.
Beth, what's the heat on Massey Energy at this point? We've seen reports all week long about the long string of violations and fines of Massey Energy, which owns the mine through a subsidiary there. We've seen the CEO out front and talking a fair amount this week. But what's the West Virginia mining community response to Massey at this point?
Well, Massey has a reputation in West Virginia. Massey has a reputation, and Mr. Blankenship, fairly or unfairly, has a reputation of being a fellow who wants to just mine coal, and he wants to be left alone about it.
Don Blankenship, the CEO.
He doesn't particularly care for regulations. He doesn't particularly care for rules. He will put up with them, and he will abide by them. But for the most part, he's a guy who wants to mine coal, sell coal, market coal, use coal. There are a number of violations at this mine, a number since January, even. There is due process. Mr. Blankenship and the owners of the Big Branch mine can ask that their violations be reconsidered, and they do that. As a matter of fact, Associated Press has revealed that ever since the Sago mine disaster, that they have found that a number of these violations are always fought by the mining industry now. Rather than just saying, okay, that's a violation, all right, we'll take our licks, we'll do our due, we'll fix it, and that's it. They kind of bottle it all up in the administration.
I see. By fighting it, it means it doesn't proceed, that maybe the response isn't required.
That's what we need to find out. Mm-hmm. How is the response?
Well,
is the response on this? And the violations, as I understand it, this is a very complex situation. And what happened after Sago is that we all thought that this had all been worked out, that the violations that a mining company gets, they will make matters better. They will rectify the situation. They will pay their fines. But perhaps that has not worked as well as the mine officials, that the federal agency, the MSHA, had hoped. And now perhaps that needs to be revisited. This whole structure of mine safety violations needs to be revisited.
The whole country watching for what finally comes out of the mine there at Upper Big Branch. Beth Voorhees is producer and host at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, joined us there from Charleston, West Virginia. Beth, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Tom.
Rescue teams went into the mine this morning. Here's West Virginia Governor Joe Manchin at a morning press conference.
We had four crews go in. 32 of our brave rescuers are in the mines right now. They are advancing.
Four miners this morning still not found in the mine as of this morning. Here's Miranda Clemens sympathizing with the wives of those miners. Her husband, John, survived.
I couldn't imagine as a wife what they're going through, knowing that their miners are under there and hurt and dead. And there's no way I could even express in words what that feels like.
And last night, Pastor Gary Williams held a prayer service for the victims of the mine explosion. Williams Church, the New Life Assembly, is near the Upper Big Branch mine, and Williams himself is a mine worker. He spoke to NPR at the service.
This disaster is kind of personal. I feel like a numbness on everybody's, an unbelief that has actually taken place. Even though it's 2 days old now, it's still hard to believe. We get in the back of our minds sometimes that those things just don't happen here, but it's a proven fact that it does. And, people are just devastated by it.
Let's turn now to two men who do the work with us now. Also from the studios of West Virginia Public Broadcasting is Jeffrey Harris. He works for Patriot Coal in the Harris No. 1 mine, no relation, in Farley, West Virginia. His mine backs up underground to the Upper Big Branch mine south of Charleston. He's 54 and a sixth generation miner. He's been working in the mines for 30 years. Jeffrey Harris, Mr. Harris, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
How you doing, Tom?
Pretty well. Very glad to have you. Also with Jeffrey at West Virginia Public Broadcasting is Adam Vance. He works for the Cleveland Cliffs Mining Company, the Pinnacle Mine in Pineville, West Virginia, about 40 miles from the Upper Big Branch Mine. He's 27 and has been mining for 5 years already. His father and grandfather both were coal miners. Adam, Mr. Vance, thank you for coming in. I know it was a drive.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
And with us from Frostburg, Maryland, at Frostburg State University is David McAteer, former head of the Mine Health and Safety Administration under President Clinton. He's now vice president of sponsored programs at Wheeling Jesuit University.
He's written deep investigative reports on earlier disasters at the Sago and Aracoma mines. David McAteer, welcome back to On Point. Sadly, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Tom, and hello.
Jeffrey Harris, you've got a lot of experience down in the mines. How do you picture what may have happened here? When you think about it, what do you think went on?
Well, what I think that went on was that I worked at the Cleveland Cliff Mines over in Pineville before, prior to me going to Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked at, in between that, I worked for Massey for a little while, and I only can speak from what I experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And they have just got away with so much for so long, just the way they do things. And it's just caught up with them. I mean, when I worked for them, I was really concerned about my safety all the time because they preach it outside, but when you go into mines, the first thing they want you to do is tear all the ventilation down and mine coal. It didn't matter who died or what happened. You better get the coal or you leave her.
Tear the ventilation down and mine coal. And now we're talking about very likely a methane explosion. That's what ventilation is all about, that getting that and coal dust out.
Exactly. And, you know, I was never used to that because I come from a union operation and we practice safety, the company practice safety, and ventilation was the big issue at our mines because we was a gassy mines at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to Massey, it was like, it really disheartened me that the men had to go through what they had to go through.
Candlelight vigil yesterday in Westville, West Virginia. A woman spoke to a crowd of hundreds and encouraged them to pray for the still trapped miners.
But if you're from West Virginia, you know coal miners. They're our family, whether they're our family or not. Our friends are our family. And we're here to show support, and we're here to pray. We still have four men underground that I know that the good Lord and Savior can reach down and touch them.
And here's Michelle McKinney, daughter of Benny Willingham, a miner confirmed dead at Upper Big Branch.
He loved to travel. He loved his grandbabies. He loved us. He was a family man, and he loved the Lord. We know where he's at, but we still want him back.
We're joined by two West Virginia coal miners this hour. Jeffrey Harris and Adam Vance join us from Charleston, West Virginia. And David McAteer, former head of Mine Health and Safety Administration, is with us from Frostburg, Maryland. Let's get a call from New York, Amherst, New York. Rick, you're on the air.
Yeah, my condolences on what's an awful day, an awful week for these fellas and their families. I think your panelists have already answered my question. It appears that unionized mines are safer, and what's preventing us from having more unionized mines? Maybe turn back the clock in a positive way so that we have unions that seem to be, that can be a backstop to what is companies like Massey who are running wild with their employees. That's my question.
We've got it, Rick, and I thank you for your call. We've got more along that same line here from a web comment from Ann, who says, almost every one of us who flips on an electric appliance lives off the backs of these miners, whether in West Virginia or other parts of the country. She said her first question is that her understanding is that the Big Branch Mine, the Sago Mine, were not unionized. What are the implications? And second, she's been told by a West Virginia friend that some coal companies actually build the cost of fines and lost personnel into their budgets, and as a result, don't take fines seriously. She's looking for your comments. Adam, what do you say?
Definitely. From the mines that I've been on, I've worked two non-union mines and one union mine, and definitely the union mine is far more safer than a non-union. With the union mine, you can step up to the plate when something's unsafe, and you say, look, it's unsafe. I'm not going to do it. We need to get it corrected. And you've got the union, your union brothers or sisters up there that's working with you that will back you. And also miners' representatives, the whole union will come in and say, look, it's not safe. We're not going to do it. Whereas in a non-union mine, when you step up and say, hey, it's not safe, I don't feel I should be doing this, they look at you and say, basically, are you going to do it? And you tell them, no, not until we get it corrected. Then they say, well, Go ahead and get your stuff and go. We've got 12, 14, 15 other people outside that's willing to take your job. And as far as getting them unionized, you know, it's hard to go when you and talk to these people when you go to try to organize a place, and the bosses or the guys that operate the non-union mines look at their workers and tell them you vote union, and just shut it down. We just don't run it. You know, these guys have to make a living for their family. They can't just up and throw everything they've worked for away. So, you know, they're faced with a big dilemma, and there needs to be some kind of point where these companies can't push these guys away from a safety choice like that as far as union. You know, the companies, there seems to be something. I think from what I've understood from hearing other people talk, that there's something maybe going to come on the table or something called the Freedom of Choice Act, and maybe that will give us a chance to where we can get more mines unionized, and these people won't have to worry and be scared about having their name out there when they vote union. You know, there's a lot of these non-union people will not speak up because they're by themselves against the coal companies, whereas when you're union, when one stands up, we all stand united, we all stand tall, and we all tell the companies, you know, we're not going to take this, and we've got the whole entire union backing us, whereas with non-union, you're basically by yourself.
Mr. Vance, what about just turning in another direction, finding another career, leaving the mine?
Well, you know, I thought of that when I first got out of high school. I've not been out of school but 7 years. I graduated in 2000. I married my high school sweetheart. Me and her we're still married. We've got two kids. I've tried about every job around here that's in the state. We didn't want to move away from our families. I just could not make it on the living, you know, $6, $7, $8 an hour. We just could not provide the life for my kids and for my family that I wanted to. So the only thing around was the coal industry. You know, you make good money at it. It's something, and I take a lot of pride in what I do. I feel like I do it well. I feel like it's an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. You know, there's no cheating nobody. It's unsafe, sure, but, you know, driving your vehicle from town to town is unsafe. So, you know, you take risks in everything you do. So, but the main thing that keeps me going is knowing that the safety's there as long as I'm willing to do it, and knowing that the union is there to back me if there's something unsafe, and knowing that with what I'm doing, it's helping a lot of people, not only in the country but in the world. And it's not only electrical appliances and the electricity that goes on. It's also steel. Coal goes in making the steel for automobiles, for buildings, for bridges, for a lot of the structures in this world wouldn't be if it wasn't for coal. So.
Rescue crews were just 1,000 feet, we're told, from one of the rescue chambers this morning when they then had to pull back because of gas still in the mines. At a press conference this morning, Kevin Strickland, a federal mining administrator, mine safety administrator, said he had told families of the missing miners that efforts had been suspended.
We've just briefed the families and explained to them the situation we're in. They've been very patient with us, and they understand what the rescue workers are going through to try to get in there, but they also understand the importance of the safety of the rescue personnel.
Everybody knows that, but still the mystery and the waiting. In an interview with the Associated Press earlier this week, Albert Bonds, who once worked, like my guests, for Massey, he worked at the Upper Big Branch mine, now works at a coal prep plant, said that miners are aware their job can be dangerous.
They're somewhat like a soldier, I think, because every time you go underground, there's always a slight possibility you might not come out. But that's the occupation you've chosen. That's how you earn your living and feed your family.
Let's go to Iowa City, Iowa. And Rick, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Excuse me. I just heard an interview last night from a man who's written on the subject. And he pointed out that even with the fines for companies like Massey, if it's taken split up over a number of years, it could be $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, and paying the fines off. Bottom line is, it's cheaper than making the changes to make it safe. And I was wondering if that is the case, and if so, perhaps we should follow the Chinese model and treat the managers and the owners a little more harshly, perhaps. prison or something else like that, and I'll take my response off here. Thank you.
Rick, I thank you for your call. Let me get one more on that line. Cambridge, Massachusetts. George, you're on the air, George.
Hi. Question, what is U.S. code on mine regulation? For example, transportation is 49 U.S.C. The U.S. code, of course, provides the specifics of the regulation, the canary, so to speak, the wire that would go. I mean, the fact that they've lost communication already indicts them. I mean, they should not have lost communication. That is a deficiency in the code. I'm sure if Barack Obama, who, as you know, graduated from Harvard here, were in charge, and he is in charge, of course, and unfortunately he's too busy. But, you know, the whole question is one of regulation, the specifics of the measurement, the company that makes the measurement devices, and why it should happen like this.
Measuring the gas. Let us look at that as well, George, and thank you for your call. David McAteer, first to you then. Our Iowa caller says, is it cheaper just to pay the fines and fix the problems? And what about how this is tracked by the government? Can it not be tracked in such a way that that ignoring the rules is impossible?
There are two good questions, Tom, and I think the first is that some companies do treat this, appear to treat this as a cost of doing business. And since the Sego disaster, levels have increased, the numbers of fines have increased, and both of those increases have been dramatic. Companies have also changed their tactics, including Massey, and they challenge now every citation that's above the minimum level. And they do that for purposes of, one, sort of bollocking up the system so that when the lawyer from the government comes, meets with them, they say, we've got $3,000, we'll pay you 25 cents on the dollar to compromise. And the urgency of the day, frequently the compromise is there, or we'll litigate the whole thing. And the second reason they do that is that there was an effort on the part of the federal Congress to increase the penalty scale or dimensions by putting in a pattern of violations, that if you got a number of points, like on your driver's license, mm-hmm. that after a period of time you had to either give up your driver's license or you were called a pattern violator and you had to work under a certain pattern. So, but those pattern points didn't respond to you or didn't come on your card until the citations were made permanent, until they were finally litigated. So what happens is that these fellows, clever lawyers that they are, use due process and say, we're going to bollocks up the system, we're going to challenge each one of these, and they never become final. So that has had a negative effect on these, on the penalties themselves. And so I think that there are companies who do that. The actual fact is, though, that if a company wants to be responsible, they're going to be responsible, and they're going to say, if we've got citations and violations in the area of roof control or ventilation, whatever, we need to fix that. And don't turn it over to the lawyers, but there are some companies who apparently have taken a different tact, and it looks, on the face of it, like Massey is one of those who's taken that tact.
Jeffrey Harris, you know this firsthand. What is the danger? What can set off the methane gas? What kind of thing can set off an explosion of methane gas in a mine, in a coal mine, if you're not careful?
Well, it's a number of things. You could have a roof fall if you have the right mixture with a roof fall, or you have a right mixture of gas and the air is not right. It could happen. But, you know, I'm just getting back to what had happened on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
We had a storm to come through, and environmental pressure dropped.
Okay.
Where methane rises. And they had that much. They had gas already, but this accumulation of more gas come up.
From lower in the mine when the atmospheric pressure drops.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this 5 hours prior to the storm. And these things happen. That's when you have to keep a close eye. When you're longwalling coal, you have more gas because you have bleeders and your gas is in your gob line.
What does longwalling coal mean, Mr. Harris?
It's what you do is it's a shear and it's a pan line. What they do is drive these blocks like 10,000 foot, and they have like 1,000 foot faces.
Mm-hmm.
And a miner is on a pan line. It's what it really mounts to.
Mm-hmm.
And it cuts from one end to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about, you get so much coal, so much more coal out of these type of mining that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't rock dust, if you just let the float dust just lay like Massey does, mm-hmm. they don't care. They think they can outrun it all.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, it'll catch up with you. You know, the gas is there. Gas is not a problem if you take care of it. Gas is a problem when you ignore it.
When you're in the mine, Adam Vanson, I know you work midnight to 8 a.m., the graveyard shift there, so you can be with your kids. I think they're 7 and 3 during the day. But is gas on your mind? Is dust on your mind? Are they always on your mind?
Yeah, they're on my mind, you know, not as well as not only the gas, but, you know, the roof falls and all that. All the inherited dangers of going underground, you know, are, mm-hmm. they're always on your mind. But you can't focus in on them and always just worry about them all the time, because if you did, you know, you'd drive yourself crazy. You'd be so paranoid you just couldn't function. So you have right. to put them to the back of your mind. You know, a little, but not so far back that you can't, you know, watch for them and do it safely. You know, I believe that's what a lot of people are doing nowadays, because that's what they're told from their companies. They're putting it so far back that they care about it, but they can't do nothing about it. You know, the gas and stuff like that, it can be mined. The coal can be mined safely with the gas. You know, you just have to take the proper ventilation steps, the proper rock dust steps. You have mm-hmm. to take all the proper steps that the federal government has installed in laws and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if everybody would just remember that, but you know, the workplaces would be a whole lot safer if we could do that.
Let's go to La Crosse, Wisconsin, and our caller Richard. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Quite often I hear the caller saying that the miners keep going down there, but because it's such good money. How much does a miner make on the average per year?
Thank you, Richard. Jeffrey, how about it? What's the range for a union miner? And from my understanding, non-union miners, for Massey, for example, might actually make more with fewer benefits. But if you're union, non-union, what's the range of what a miner can make in a year?
Well, when I made up to $100,000 a year if I want to work that much. Now, at Massey, you probably can make $200,000 a year.
Seriously? Mean, with like,
yeah.
Was that like overtime every day,
yes,
every week?
That's, yeah, yeah. But Massey works you 12 hours a day. They work you 16 hours a day every day. So, and if you want to do it, you can make as much money as you want.
What's the more standard kind of, you know, what people actually make if they're not killing themselves with overtime all the time?
About $50,000 to $60,000 a year. I mean, that's mm-hmm. just probably based on 5 or 6 days a week at 8 hours a day. I mean, you can make that kind of money.
Adam, are there alternatives where you could make that kind of money in your region? From what you're saying, I guess not.
No, not. Southern West Virginia is primarily coal country. That's pretty much what they call it around here. There's coal mines. Anywhere you make a turn, there's a coal mines. If they're not there, they're ready to be faced up and go in. So that's pretty much the only job. In the small towns that we live in, there's no real large towns around, you know, Charleston, and we have one down a little bit farther south of Charleston and Beckley, but they're not. The towns that we live in are so small that's what they strive off of is the coal industry. If the coal mines was to up and leave or be shut down and the people quit working the mines, you know, they'd all be shut down. They'd be nothing.
Jeffrey, you're 54, been in the mines for 30 years. Six generations of your family have gone into the mines. You're the sixth. But my understanding is that your children have not gone into the mines. Did you discourage them from doing it? Did you say this is not a life for you? Was it their own decision?
Well, I try to encourage them to get education and go and try something else, because coal mining is dangerous, and I'm the last of my generation of my family to work in the mines, and I just didn't want them to go through what I have to go through. And I think their life, forest, their health, and everything. You know, people, we talk about these explosions, but we talk about all these other health issues that we have in the coal industry, with the breathing the air and the black lung and the rock dust and just so many different things that we suffer after coal mining, you know. So mm-hmm. I didn't want them to go through that. My father tried to get me to understand that, but I wouldn't. I said, no, and I got used to that money. And mm-hmm. once you get used to that money, that's what you're going to do, you know.
So the dangers are there. Adam Vance, I wish you'd explain something I'm sure a lot of people are mulling over this week. We have this tragedy, this big disaster, at least 25 people dead. And you know what the dangers are there. And yet, when the media have descended on West Virginia and talked with miners, again and again, even in their grief, I've heard them say they love mining.
Well, it's kind of in your blood, I guess. Your family does it for so long, and it is a really good job. It's a steady job. You know, the coal industry is usually there. It's hard physical work a lot of times. You know, you have to really do some back breaking work at times. But you know, it is fun. It's fun and an enjoyable job. You get to go in and you get to mess around with the different machinery that they have that does the coal cutting. You know, you can joke around and play around with some of the guys that you've got there and women that you work with. You know, it's a lot like family once you get to the mines too. And a lot of these places, you stay. A man has to work so much, or a woman has to work so much at these mines now that you stay more at the mines than you do with your actual family. So these people are more like family to, or just as much family to you as your own wife and kids would be. So you know, you get a newfound love and everything for the people around you. So,
Adam, you said you married your high school sweetheart. What does she think of it when you're away those long hours and you're underground with the danger there? How does she feel when she waves you off every day?
She's worried, you know, just as well as all of them are, but she as well has to put it back in the back of her mind too. If she sat there and thought about all the dangers and stuff that I have to go through to make the living for us, to provide the life that we have, then you know, she would probably go crazy herself. You know, she'd be so paranoid. You know, she knows the dangers, and she don't want me to go through it. But she knows, really, at this time of and point in my life, that's what we have to do to make the living. So,
Jeffrey Harris, when you're down in the mine, and we're talking far in mines very often. We've learned, if we didn't know already, in this week, even miles. When you're way down in the shaft, is that just as comfortable to you after 30 years in the business as being out, you know, under the bright sun on a nice day? Are you just as comfortable there or not?
Oh, yeah. I really enjoy my job. And it's when I'm at work, I feel just like I'm at home. I mean, with the men that I work with, the things that we do, you know, in the mines, I feel like I'm right there. I mean, it's not bad. I mean, I really enjoy my job. And coal mining is not a bad job. I mean, it's a good job. It's a good provider. And I really enjoy it. I mean, if I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't have stayed as long as I did. You know, but this day and time, we shouldn't have to have these situations that we're having. We shouldn't have explosions. We shouldn't have. It's no excuse for them, because with the laws and what we know, It just shouldn't happen. I mean, we are going backwards.
David McAteer, you're listening to all this, and our time grows short. Excuse me, Jeffrey, but David, what do we owe these men and women? And what about the going backwards charge? Is that possible, that our mines are becoming less safe?
Well, I think that statistically they're becoming more safe. I think what Jeffrey is pointing out that is that there are mines being operated in unsafe fashions, and that we know how to prevent accidents. We know how to prevent disasters. The law exists. It's where people don't comply with it, and people don't pay attention to it, and people don't follow basic safety practices. That's where we get into situations where we have explosions.
Adam, when's your next shift, my friend?
It'll be tonight on the midnight shift. It'll be a Friday shift. Go in tonight. I'll leave my house around 10:30.
Mm-hmm.
Show up for work about. I'll get it at the mine site at about 11:30, 11 somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. Get changed and start underground about 10 after 12 after we have our nightly safety meeting. So,
and come up around 8 the next morning.
Around 8, 9, or 10. It just depends on if we have to work over or not. So.
And Jeffrey Harris, when do you go down again?
I work tomorrow. I'm on day shift. I work from 8 to 4, and we just work 8-hour days, and by 5 o'clock I'm back home in the evenings, and my wife get home at 5. We have dinner and enjoy the day.
Well, we wish you safe and productive shifts. We thank you for the energy that comes there, and we've got a lot to think about after this disaster at Upper Big Branch. Jeffrey Harris, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Adam Vance, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And David McAteer, thank you as always. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.